What the jury had made of these courtroom antics and of the ocean of confused and inconclusive evidence was impossible to say. But for many of the spectators in court on that wet afternoon of March 13, 1891, and for the immense throng of New Orleanians crowded on the street outside St. Patrick's Hall, there was no doubt at all. At least some of the nine defendants had to be guilty. And though the judge had given a directed verdict of not guilty for two of the defendants for lack of evidence, the rest simply must be punished. No other outcome, according to the newspapers at least, was acceptable. At 1:30 p.m., a knock was finally heard at the door of the deliberation room. Sheriff Gabriel Villery hurried through the door and went upstairs to consult with the jurors. After a few minutes, as nervous murmurs swept through the courtroom, Villery reappeared and crossed the room to the private office of Judge Joshua G. Baker. And when the judge himself came out into the courtroom, ordering Villery to ring up the parish prison and have the prisoners delivered to court, there was no longer any room for doubt. The wait was over. After nearly a full day of deliberations, the jury had finally reached a verdict. Judge Baker ordered the courtroom cleared of everyone except members of the bar and the press. All others had to join the unruly crowds waiting outside. The excitement on the street was even greater than it had been on the morning of the chief's death. Police Secretary Vandervoort, anticipating trouble, telephoned the central station for an extra detail of police to control the multitudes. The police, after all, didn't want any harm to come to the defendants, at least not until a proper verdict had been delivered. At around 2:30 p.m., the jury filed into the courtroom. Most of the 12 members were averting their eyes. Although this is usually a bad sign for the defendants, few jurors like to meet the gaze of men they are condemning, this was not necessarily the case here. The accusations of jury tampering had created an atmosphere of suspicion in the courtroom, and the jurors knew that their judgments would be met with skepticism, no matter what the outcome. The jury foreman, Jacob Seligman, handed the written verdict to the clerk, who passed it on to Judge Baker. After instructing the defendants to rise, the judge opened the folded paper and read the contents. He stared at the note for nearly a full minute, in what some reporters later interpreted as disapproval. Then he announced the jury's findings to the room. The verdict came as a shock to nearly everyone. With regard to three of the defendants, including the apparently deranged Polizzi, the jury had been deadlocked. A mistrial was declared, meaning that all three would have to be retried. As for the other six, everyone from the wealthy shipper Maceca to Asperi Marchesi, the young boy accused of whistling to alert the assassins to the chief's approach, the decision was unanimous. All were found not guilty. This outcome caused the spectators in the courtroom to turn and look at one another in mute amazement. But then the shouting began, both inside and outside the courthouse. Reporters rushed the dismissed jurors as they gathered up their belongings to leave. Besieged with questions, they refused to reveal anything about their decision. Sheriff Villery, knowing the reception they were likely to get outside, advised them to exit the building by the side door. But after some discussion, the jurors decided to brave the judgment of their fellow citizens. They left by the main courthouse door. And although the mob outside was unruly and belligerent, the jurors were able to push through the milling throngs unmolested. A boy in the crowd, apparently convinced that the bribery rumors were true, shouted to one juror, "Say, how much did you get?" The nine defendants, on the other hand, were met with more overt hostility. Though six of them had been acquitted of the murder charges, all had to be returned to prison until certain lesser charges against them could be formally withdrawn. They were thus again returned to the Black Marias waiting outside. A detail of police tried to hold back the jeering mob to clear a path. Despite some scuffling, as spectators pushed against police lines, the prisoners were loaded into the vans without incident. Even so, a howl of frustrated rage rose up in their wake as they departed. The afternoon newspaper editorials about the outcome were blistering. "Red-handed murder struck at the law itself," the Daily Item proclaimed. "And the agencies of the law were found impotent to punish the foul deed." The writer for the Daily States was utterly apoplectic. "Alien hands of oath-bound assassins have set the blot of a martyr's blood upon your vaunted civilization. And yet the spillers of that blood were now to be set free." Such a verdict, according to the paper, was an affront to justice, a grievous injury that admitted only one possible solution: Rise, people of New Orleans. It was a suggestion that some people of New Orleans were already seriously contemplating. When William S. Parkerson stepped into his second-floor law office at 7 Commercial Place that evening, he found several dozen agitated men waiting for him, with more arriving at the office door every minute. Parkerson had been in another courtroom all afternoon, but by now he had heard about the outcome of the Hennessy trial. So he knew why these men were here. Incensed by the verdicts, they were looking to him for guidance on how to write what they all regarded as a blatant miscarriage of justice. That the men in his office, some of them much older and more prominent than he, should now turn to Parkerson for leadership was not surprising. Balding, bespectacled, and somewhat portly, the 35-year-old lawyer may not have looked the part of the dynamic leader of men, but his intensity in the courtroom was legendary. A powerful natural orator, he had been a political force in the Young Men's Democratic Association for some time already. But it was his position as alleged leader of the YMDA's unofficial militia that explained why these men were at his office. Described by one historian as a Southern special gentleman's police, Parkerson's so-called regulators included many of the city's most prominent citizens. These were the men who had brought Mayor Shakespeare and his reform government into office, and who now felt it their job to correct the mistake the jurors had made that day. After 15 minutes, Parkerson broke up the meeting, instructing the men in his office to assemble again later that night. They would meet at the home of Franklin Brevard Hayne, a young cotton merchant who was also a leader of the regulators' militia. And when they reconvened in the parlor of Hayne's home, at the corner of Royal and Bienville Streets in the Vieux Carré, their ire was, if anything, stoked even higher than before. Many had heard stories of raucous demonstrations in the Italian colony that day. One report even had some Italians spitting on an American flag in joyous defiance. To the 150 men present, the meaning of this was obvious. The Mafia Society was flaunting its power, celebrating its victory over the forces of law and order in New Orleans. Many at the meeting wanted to march to the parish prison at that very moment to exact their revenge. But Parkerson dissuaded them. Convinced that any such vigilante action needed a popular mandate behind it, he argued instead for a mass meeting to be held the next morning, a gathering that would attract a large number of participants. And so, together they composed an announcement to be printed in all of the morning papers. Signed by 61 men, it read, "Mass Meeting. All good citizens are invited to attend a mass meeting on Saturday, March 14th at 10 o'clock a.m. at Clay Statue, to take steps to remedy the failure of justice in the Hennessy case. Come prepared for action." The announcement did not specify what action was meant, but Parkerson's intentions were clearly telegraphed by what he did next. After adjourning the meeting at Hayne's house, he and a select group of trusted friends rode a horse-drawn wagon to a hardware store across town. There they loaded it up with an ample supply of rope, plenty of ammunition, and 150 Winchester rifles and shotguns. Then they carried this arsenal back to Haynes's, where they loaded it into several large trunks to be easily available the next day. When Sheriff Gabriel Villery read the newspapers the next morning, he was under no illusions about the probable result of the announced mass meeting, and he wanted to be ready for it. Whatever his own sympathies, he was responsible for the safety of the 19 prisoners in his charge. So, at 8:30 a.m., he left his office at the parish prison and headed toward City Hall to find Mayor Shakespeare. If the crowds at the mass meeting turned into an unruly mob, he wanted the mayor to give him more men, or maybe even help from the state militia. At roughly the same time of the morning, Pasquale Corte, Italy's consul to New Orleans, was heading through the streets in the same direction. The announcement in the papers had distressed the consul considerably. At least two of the defendants in the trial were Italian nationals, and Corte saw it as his responsibility to make certain of their safety. So he, too, was going to see the mayor, hoping to persuade him to protect the acquitted men. Sheriff Villery was already at City Hall when Corte arrived, but both were to be disappointed. Neither Mayor Shakespeare nor his secretary were in their offices, and no one seemed to know where they were. Chief of Police Dexter Gaster, Hennessy's successor, was present, but the neophyte chief seemed reluctant to do more than send a few extra patrolmen over to the parish prison. If Corte and Villery wanted any greater precaution than that, they would have to speak to the mayor, who, conveniently, some would later say, wasn't due in City Hall before noon. Frustrated and in a state of rising alarm, Corte and Villery hurried over to consult with Louisiana Governor Francis T. Nichols, who was known to be in town at his lawyer's office. But here they got no help either. Nichols, a white-haired former Confederate general, seemed sympathetic to their concerns, but he claimed that there was nothing he could do to aid them. To deploy the militia in any city, he would have to receive an official written request from its mayor. Without such a document, he said, he was powerless. But Nichols at least knew where Shakespeare could be found. The mayor was breakfasting at the Pickwick Club. If the gentleman would simply have a seat, he would send a message over to the club and ask Mayor Shakespeare to come to the office. By this time, crowds were already gathering at the foot of the Henry Clay statue, which in 1891 still stood on the neutral ground, the median, of Canal Street at the intersection of Royal. At 10 o'clock, when Parkerson and his self-styled Vigilance Committee arrived on the scene, approximately 6,000 to 8,000 citizens already thronged the avenue. Intersections were blocked to traffic, and the Canal Street trolleys were so swamped that they could barely move. Amid shouts and cheering, Parkerson and the other leaders of the committee got the meeting started. They marched 3 times around the monument to give the other leaders a chance to fall in behind them. Then Parkerson climbed the steps to the foot of the statue. He took off his hat as another cheer rose up from the crowd. "People of New Orleans, once before I stood before you for public duty," he began, referring to his role in the 1888 elections. "I now appear before you again, actuated by no desire for fame or prominence. Affairs have reached such a crisis that men living in an organized and civilized community, finding their laws fruitless and ineffective, are forced to protect themselves. When courts fail, the people must act." Again, the crowd roared its approval. By now, spectators had climbed to the roofs of the paralyzed streetcars to get a better view. Others looked on with opera glasses from nearby windows and balconies. "What protection is there left us," Parkerson went on, "when the very head of our police department, our chief of police, is assassinated in our very midst by the Mafia Society, and his assassins are again turned loose on the community? The time has come for the people of New Orleans to say whether they are going to stand for these outrages. I ask you to consider this fairly. Are you going to let it continue? Will every man here follow me and see the murder of D.C. Hennessy vindicated? Are there men enough here to set aside the verdict of that infamous jury, every one of whom is a perjurer and a scoundrel?" The roar of the spectators left no doubt about their answer, and after a few other men had made speeches from the foot of the great pacificator, the crowd, excited to a frenzied pitch, heeded Parkerson's final words. "Men and citizens of New Orleans, follow me. I will be your leader." The crowd parted as Parkerson and the other leaders made their way down Royal Street. At Haynes's house on the corner of Bienville, a previously selected group of men armed themselves with shotguns, Winchester rifles, and rope that they had cached there the night before. Then they returned to Canal Street and began their march toward the parish prison. The crowd accordingly fell in line, 3 and 4 abreast, the Daily Item would later report. The vanguard was composed of the most wealthy and respected citizens of New Orleans. They were followed by honest, hard-working mechanics, tradesmen, and laborers. Here was a body of men on their way to do what the law had failed to do. The mob moved like a mighty roaring stream along Canal and then turned right up Rampart toward Congo Square. Along the way, crying women waved handkerchiefs from galleries, shouting men climbed on beer and grocery wagons, on awnings and rooftops, encouraging the marchers forward. Some began chanting, "Who killed the chief? Who killed the chief?" a hateful ethnic taunt that would be flung at the Italians of New Orleans for decades to come. The few policemen in the crowd were driven out of the path under a salvo of stones and clumps of mud. The armed men at the head of the procession marched on with almost military discipline. "It was the most terrible thing I ever saw," Parkerson would later boast to the newspapers. "The quiet determination of the crowd. There was no disorder." With a Winchester rifle in one hand and a revolver tucked into his pocket, Parkerson led his followers to Congo Square, just 1 block from the prison. Here he stopped and addressed them again about the grave duty they were about to perform. Two municipal detectives left the park and ran ahead to the parish prison to alert Warden Lemuel Davis of the approaching mob. The warden realized that it was too late to move the inmates to another location. He and his men would just have to hold off the mob as best they could. Moving quickly, he ordered that the doors to the prison be barred from the inside. After calling the central station with an urgent request for reinforcements, he went to see the prisoners in their cell on the second floor, a large, low-security area called the Star Chamber, where they were waiting for their release. When told of the approaching mob, Joseph Macheka, the most prominent of the prisoners, asked the warden that they all be given arms to defend themselves. Davis refused, but did agree to release them from the cell for their own safety. He sent a guard over to the women's section of the prison, ordering that the female inmates be moved to allow the Italians to hide there. Then, he turned a set of keys over to the prisoners and allowed them to scatter throughout the cavernous building. By this time, the mob had reached the front gate of the prison. Officers from the 4th Precinct Station, which shared the same building as the prison, made futile attempts to keep the banquet clear in front of the entrance. One deputy sheriff pushed a man away from the gate, only to have the man silently raise a pistol to his head. "I've done all I can," the officer declared, backing away from the gate with his hands raised. Eventually, Parkerson himself stepped up to the iron gate and called out to Warden Davis. He asked that the keys to the gate be turned over, on the authority of the people of New Orleans. Davis refused, and refused again after Parkerson threatened to break down the gate. Frustrated, the lawyer ordered that gunpowder and some stout pieces of wood be found to batter through the gate. He also sent a contingent around to the side of the massive prison, where a far less imposing wooden doorway led from the street to the warden's private office. It was the side door that eventually gave way. Though prison guards had nailed wooden boards across the inside of the door, Parkerson's men were able to batter it in with cobblestones and railroad ties taken from a nearby construction site. Parkerson stationed several guards at the splintered door while his hand-picked squad of executioners entered, leaving everyone else outside. A locked gate still stood between the armed men and their prey inside the prison, but this proved to be just a temporary hindrance. The men quickly broke the padlock and threw the gate back on its hinges. The armed vigilantes now fanned out through the enormous building as other inmates of the prison, among them Philip Lebrano, still incarcerated while awaiting trial for the murder of Peter Dubler, looked on. According to some reports, Parkerson had beforehand made up a list of the prisoners to be executed and those to be spared. The boy, Asperi Marchese, for one, was to be left alone, presumably because of his age. So, too, were the two defendants given a directed not guilty verdict by the judge. But the others were to be captured and marched outside, there to be judged and executed with great solemnity. "The intention had been not to shoot any of them," Parkerson would later tell an interviewer. "But that's not how it happened. When my men were inside, there were about 50 of them. They got very furious, and after the first taste of blood, it was impossible to keep them back." Several of the executioners ran into the now deserted prison yard. One of them saw a face at a window on the second floor. "There's Scafidi," he yelled, identifying one of the defendants, and he raised his revolver and fired. This was all the encouragement the others needed. Breaking discipline, they also fired at the window, shredding its whitewashed frame and sending down a shower of white dust and shards of wood. Warden Davis rushed into the yard, urging calm and restraint, but the men merely pushed past him toward the stairway to the second floor. Now the killing began in earnest. Egged on by the crowds outside, which began cheering and screaming at the first sound of gunfire, the executioners set off after their quarry. Macheka was the first to be found. Spotted from below, he and two others were in a third-floor gallery, where they had run, against the warden's advice, to find a route out of the prison. Macheka was trying key after key to open a locked door that would have led into the 4th Precinct police station. As his pursuers rushed up the stairs, he gave up on the keys and began hammering the padlock with an Indian club. But the lock would not give. Macheka spun around as the gate from the stairs to the gallery burst open and was immediately shot in the face. The two men with him were also killed, one shot long range from the floor below. The other, the father of Asperi Marchese, had been thrown back against a wall when the gate flew open. As he stood there, dazed by the blow to his head, two men with shotguns approached and triumphantly discharged them into his chest. Others were being routed elsewhere in the prison. Seven of the Italians had fled as instructed to the women's section of the prison, but they were soon found by one of the execution squads. Flushed from their hiding places, the prisoners huddled together at one corner of the women's yard. They were begging for mercy, but the vigilantes had by this time lost all restraint. They lifted their weapons and fired indiscriminately into the gaggle of men. Five were killed instantly, and a sixth was shot again when he lifted a trembling arm from the pile of bodies. One of the prisoners in the pile, Antonio Bagnetto, was found still alive. He was unceremoniously dragged from the yard and carried out to the front of the prison. Emanuele Polizzi, the supposed madman, had also been found alive and was likewise pulled outside. And there, amid cheers and shouts from the crowd, both men were strung up on ropes. Bagnetto was hanged from a tree just outside the prison, Polizzi from a lamppost at the corner of Treme and St. Anne Streets. As the bodies of the two men dangled above, they were riddled with bullets before a crowd of thousands. When all was finished, Parkerson emerged from the parish prison to resounding cheers. He himself had not fired a single shot, but he took full responsibility for the results. "Bagnetto, Scafidi, Polizzi, Joe Maceca, Monastero, and Marchese are dead," he announced to the crowd from atop an overturned streetcar. "I have performed the most painful duty of my life today. If you have confidence in me and in the gentlemen associated with me, I ask you to disperse and go quietly to your homes. You have acted like men. Now go home like men." But some in the crowd were not ready to disperse. In triumph, they marched back to the clay statue on Canal Street, carrying Parkerson on their shoulders. There, the lawyer made another speech. "You have today wiped the stain from your city's name," and then asked them again to disperse, promising that more would be done to address those accused of bribing the jury. For that day, at least, their mission was complete. Back at the parish prison, some of Parkerson's associates had arranged a gruesome tableau so that all New Orleanians could bear witness to what had been done for their welfare. The two hanged men were left swinging outside for all to see, while several other bodies were lined up in a large room inside the prison for more convenient viewing. For 5 hours, thousands of men, women, and children filed past to see them. Some of the women allegedly dipped lace handkerchiefs into pools of blood to keep as mementos of the day, while others took away bits of the victims' clothing and shoelaces. One enterprising man even began peeling strips of bark from the tree on which Bagnetto had been strung up to bring home as a souvenir. 11 men in all were killed at the Orleans Parish Prison that day. 3 of the slain had been tried and acquitted. A jury had failed to agree on 3 others. 5 more belonged to the second group of defendants that had not even been tried yet. Asked later whether he regretted what had happened in the prison, Parkerson was adamant. "Of course, it is not a courageous thing to attack a man who is not armed," he admitted. "But we looked upon these men as so many reptiles. This was a great emergency, greater than has ever happened in New York, Cincinnati, or Chicago. Hennessy's killing struck at the very root of American institutions. The intimidation of the mafia and the corruption of our juries are to be met only with strong measures. I recognize no power above the people." Parkerson was not alone in this judgment. Many in New Orleans were soon hailing the lawyer and his followers as heroes. The city's business community was virtually unanimous in its approval. The Board of Trade and the Cotton, Sugar, Produce, Lumbermen's, and Stock Exchanges all passed resolutions praising the vigilante action. The local newspapers also came to the mob's defense. "Government powers are delegated by the people," the Daily Picayune opined, "and the people can reclaim them if they feel that the power is not being executed properly." The item agreed. "When the ordinary means of justice fail, extraordinary means are resorted to. This is a characteristic of the American people, and has today been illustrated once more in a most impressive fashion." Emboldened by this definitive blow for order and self-defense, Parkerson and his vigilance committee promised further extra-legal means to ensure the submission of the so-called mafia threat. Vowing to burn down the Italian Quarter if revenge were taken on the lynchers, Parkerson proceeded to investigate claims of jury bribery, even as an official grand jury was doing likewise. Evidence was eventually found that certain members of the jury pool had indeed been promised money, but apparently no actual jurors were bribed. That didn't help the 12 men who had delivered the unpopular verdict. Many were forced to leave town, including jury foreman Jacob M. Seligman, who was summarily expelled from the stock exchange and the Young Men's Gymnastics Club. Eventually, finding life in New Orleans untenable, he moved to Cincinnati. As for the lynchers themselves, the grand jury, citing its inability to fix guilt on the entire people of the parish and city of New Orleans, indicted precisely no one, calling the incident a spontaneous uprising of the people. Those people themselves, however, were in no doubt as to who their leaders were. Parkerson, universally identified as the head of the lynch mob, became something of a national celebrity and was soon being invited to give speeches in places as distant as Boston and Bloomington, Indiana. Over the next few years, he would receive threatening letters, many of them in Italian, and his home in New Orleans would twice suffer minor damage by arsonists' fires. But neither he nor any of the others would ever suffer serious consequences, legal or otherwise, for their actions. For respectable New Orleans, then, the lynching was a triumph. Though opinion throughout the rest of the country was deeply divided, many prominent figures came out in favor of the action. Even a young Theodore Roosevelt, then a civil service commissioner in Washington, D.C., approved of it. The future president called the lynching a rather good thing, and said so at a party attended by what he described as various Dago diplomats. Those diplomats, of course, as well as their fellow Italians, both here and in Europe, had a very different perspective. In fact, the incident, regarded as the largest mass lynching in American history, caused something of a political crisis between Italy and the United States, at one point bringing the two countries dangerously close to a declaration of war. But eventually, with the payment of a $25,000 indemnity divided among the victims' families, the crisis passed. In the minds of many law-abiding citizens, both in New Orleans and in the rest of the country, Parkerson and his band had accomplished an important and worthy goal. They had taught the Crescent City's lawless Italians the harsh lesson that the city council had called for back in October. Mayor Shakespeare could not have been more pleased at the outcome. After receiving laudatory letters from all over the country, one of them praising the able manner in which you stayed at home and attended to your own private business while the prison was under siege, he was inclined to thank his friend and former campaign manager for a much-needed cleansing of the Italian community. Asked by a newspaper reporter about the position of the mafia in New Orleans after the lynching, the mayor was upbeat. "They are quiet, quieter than they have been for years," he said. "The lesson taught them at the parish prison has had a most excellent effect, and I do not anticipate we will have any more trouble with them. You may announce that the reign of the mafia in New Orleans is over." That utterance, of course, would eventually prove to be far too optimistic. But for the time being, the city's Italian underworld, mafia or not, was subdued. The Italian colony would in fact remain relatively quiet through the rest of the 1890s. But the reformers' efforts to clean up the city would not end with the killings at the Orleans Parish Prison. There were still other lessons to be taught, other threats to be neutralized. The war for control of New Orleans had actually just begun. Part 2. Drawing Boundaries, 1890s to 1907. Chapter 5. A Sporting Man. Tom Anderson was a man on the rise. In mid-1890s New Orleans, this was already a well-known fact. Now in his 30s, dapper and always well-groomed, with his pomaded reddish-brown hair and carefully waxed mustache, the young Scots-Irishman had already established himself as a shrewd businessman with a hand in many different ventures around town. In the few short years since his friend David Hennessy's unfortunate death, Tom had come far, making a name in sporting circles as a boxing manager, a horse-racing entrepreneur, and a saloon and restaurant owner with an unstinting sense of hospitality. He'd also had success in more legitimate endeavors as proprietor of a small but growing oil business, the Record Oil Company, the only independent oil company not controlled by trusts or monopolies, dispensing everything from axle grease to salad oils from a warehouse in the Central Business District. Some said Tom Anderson was extraordinarily lucky. But luck, as he well knew, was something that had to be made. Luck was hard work and handshakes. It was cultivating influential friends from all walks of life, both high and low, and making sure they were happy. And now, flush with his early success, he was even contemplating that inevitable next step, into politics, the game that in New Orleans was so often the key to greater prosperity. Tom Anderson, in short, was a man who so far had made very few mistakes in his life. Except one, namely Mrs. Tom Anderson, the former Catherine Turnbull, Tom's second wife. On January 24, 1894, in what must have been a weak moment, he'd married the pretty but combative young prostitute and had regretted it almost immediately. Their marriage had been a disaster from the beginning, a nonstop melodrama of bickering, histrionics, and recriminations. Less than a year after the wedding, Anderson was already desperate to call it quits. He sued his wife for a separation of bed and board, hoping eventually to divorce, without alimony or division of joint property, and just move on as if the whole thing had never happened. But Kate was not about to let him off so easily. She was Mrs. Anderson now. There was no way she was just going to disappear with nothing to show for their association. So she was willing to fight him in court to prevent it. That their brief marriage had come to this impasse was somewhat out of character for the genial young businessman. Tom Anderson, after all, was well known for being accommodating to everyone, willing to go along to get along, forever the man eager to do a favor that would, in the natural course of things, eventually be repaid. It was the law of the streets he grew up on, reciprocity, mutual protection. As the product of a bloody-fisted childhood in the neighborhood known as the Irish Channel, Tom had learned early in life that those who escaped the rough channel streets were those who hustled, made friends, avoided trouble, and kept an eye out for the main chance. When, as a young boy peddling the Daily Picayune on street corners, he happened to witness a petty theft on Basin Street, he did not, as so many other boys would have done, clam up when a patrolman asked him about it. Instead, he pointed out the thief's hiding place, and even agreed to testify in court about everything he'd seen. For this service, he received a small monetary reward. More important, the deed also earned him a reputation among the local constabulary as a boy who could be relied upon. Most likely, it had been a calculation on Tom's part. A sneak thief could do nothing for him, but a beat cop, well, you never knew. But Tom liked to make himself useful to others in the neighborhood as well. He wasn't overly fussy about his associates, and he was soon helping out at the local brothels, running to the corner pharmacy to fetch the ladies their regular doses of opium and cocaine. When someone told the boy that those drugs, while easy to obtain in New Orleans, were actually illegal, he obligingly agreed to forego the deliveries, at least while his police friends were watching. Though his career at school had been undistinguished and brief, Tom's mathematical abilities had nonetheless been sharp enough to land him a job early on as a bookkeeper and shipping clerk for the insurance oil company. Here he did everything right, working hard, ingratiating himself with his co-workers, and saving as much of his salary as possible. After just a few years of apprenticeship, he was ready for bigger things. One day in 1879, when he was just 19 or 20 years old, he breezed into the office and made an announcement to his colleagues. "Well, boys, I am going to leave you. I got married to a young woman uptown, and I am going into business for myself." The young woman in question was his childhood sweetheart, Emma Schwartz, the daughter of Dutch immigrants living in his old neighborhood. The newlyweds set up house downtown on St. Louis Street. And within a year, Emma gave birth to a daughter, Irene. Young as he was, Tom was apparently very happy to be a family man. "William," he told one of his old co-workers from Insurance Oil, "I got a fine little baby girl up home." But it was not to last long. In November of 1881, Emma succumbed to typhoid fever. "William," Tom told the same colleague when next they met on the street, "my wife is dead." Clearly unprepared to raise an 18-month-old child alone, he turned Irene over to the St. Vincent's Infant Asylum. There the child lived until she turned five, at which point he enrolled her in the St. Mary's Convent School in nearby Carrollton. It was hardly an ideal arrangement, but Tom apparently felt he had no choice. His own mother was working full-time as a domestic and couldn't care for the child, and Emma's family was apparently in similar circumstances. This way, at least, the baby would be close enough for him to visit when he could. The 1880s proved to be a profitable decade for the young widower. He did not, as he had told his friends, go into business for himself, at least not yet. Instead, he worked as a bookkeeper for a number of other enterprises, including the Louisiana State Lottery Company. For an ambitious young man seeking to find his way in New Orleans' semi-legitimate economy, there could have been no better training ground. Long the nemesis of Louisiana's good government reformers, W.S. Parkerson was a major foe, the lottery was a boondoggle of impressive proportions. Run as a private corporation, it was chartered by the state government to hold regular drawings and distribute cash prizes to the lucky winners. In exchange, the company donated the small sum of $40,000 annually to the charity hospital. The rest of the profits went to shareholders in the corporation. Of course, keeping such a government-sanctioned swindle in operation required copious incentives in high places, and the company's attentive bookkeeper was sure to take note of exactly how these were provided. In this way, he learned the important lesson that you had to spend money to make money, and he was careful to do likewise in his own endeavors. Tom saved where he could, but also generously contributed to political campaigns, police department benefits, and charity drives sponsored by the men's clubs he made sure to join. Soon the young lottery clerk was on intimate terms with some of the most prominent businessmen and political figures in town. These, of course, did not include the blue-blooded elites of the Boston and Pickwick clubs. They never would have looked twice at an Irish Channel man. Instead, Tom's new associates were the more down-to-earth sorts, the ward politicians and tavern owners, the newspaper reporters and fire department chiefs. These were the people a man could deal with, even if his forebears hadn't had generations in which to wipe the soil of the potato fields from the family escutcheon. And although reformers were eventually successful in getting rid of the lottery in 1893, when the company's charter expired and it was forced to move its operations to Honduras, Tom Anderson had by then gotten what he needed from the venture, having made connections in many of the significant places of power in the city. He cultivated those connections with all the care of a St. Charles Avenue yardman. When he scraped together enough money to open his first restaurant, at number 110 to 112 North Rampart Street, in collaboration with a friend named David Heller, he played the generous host to all of his police, politico, and demimonde friends. At Tom Anderson's convivial establishment, such men could always find plenty of good food and fine liquor. Perhaps most helpfully, they could also find private rooms where deals, payoffs, and rendezvous could be made, far from the prying eyes of strict constructionists of the law. In fact, Anderson's soon became known as a kind of neutral ground, a place where representatives from different spheres could meet and hammer out their mutually beneficial understandings. And whenever such parties came together, Tom Anderson was always right there, to make introductions, arbitrate disputes, and keep everyone's beer mugs full to the brim. His hospitality, "my motto," he always claimed in advertisements, "is the best of everything," was soon the stuff of urban lore. When he branched out into the boxing game, as manager of Andy Bowen, the lightweight champion of the South, there were always free tickets to distribute to his friends and associates. When the horse owned by his oil company ran a race at the city park or fairgrounds racetrack, choice grandstand seats were available to anyone who might look kindly on one of his future projects. Yes, the prickly reform types might be immune to such blandishments, and they were not above harassing him in small ways, seeing that he was fined or even briefly arrested on minor charges of illegal gambling or serving liquor on a Sunday. But these petty annoyances could always be made to go away, particularly for a man with so many friends who happened to be cops or judges. Sometime in the early 1880s, while he was still in his 20s, Anderson and another friend, Frank LaMothe, had begun sponsoring an annual Mardi Gras fete, a so-called French ball, to which ladies of a certain type were admitted free of charge. Advertised as the ball of the two well-known gentlemen, it soon became one of the most sought-after tickets of the season. To many, it was a welcome corrective to the stuffy, formal affairs sponsored by the more established carnival crews. Anderson's Fête was a kind of parody of those other celebrations, which had grown up in the decades after Reconstruction. Elite crews like Comus, Momus, and the Twelfth Night Revelers had been created expressly to bring order and hierarchy to Mardi Gras. Their elaborate programs of balls and processions were designed to be exclusive, in order to keep undesirables out, to push disrespectable riffraff off to the sidelines. The ball of the two well-known gentlemen, on the other hand, was the regular New Orleanians' answer to this high-handed appropriation of Mardi Gras. Like the elite cruise balls, Tom Anderson's affair featured a royal court and a series of costumed tableaus. But the queen and her court were prostitutes, not virgins from prominent families. Women in tights, not men in costumes, performed the tableaus. The result was an alternative Mardi Gras, a carnival for the city's other half. And for a man on the rise like Tom Anderson, being co-host of an event like this was priceless publicity, an excellent means of raising his profile and setting himself up as a mover and shaker in the city's semi-legitimate economy. It was at this point in his life, in the early 1890s, that he decided to give marriage a second chance. Little is known about Catherine Turnbull, the 29-year-old woman from St. Louis he married in early 1894. Apparently, she was a widow who had fallen into prostitution after the premature death of her first husband, a man named M.L. Roeder. But her profession made little difference to Tom Anderson. Having grown up as a messenger boy for Irish Channel brothels, he held little truck with the hypocrisies of Victorian moral ideals and seemed to truly enjoy the company of prostitutes. But Kate soon became an exception. Within months of his bringing her into the Britannia Street home that he shared with his widowed mother, Honora, the battle was on. The elder Mrs. Anderson developed a vehement dislike of her new daughter-in-law, and Tom, like the dutiful Irish son he was, always took his mother's side. The three Andersons argued bitterly and frequently, sometimes even in public, until matters came to a head in August of 1894. Catherine demanded that Mrs. Anderson leave the premises. Tom obliged, moving his mother, and himself, to a new house on Canal Street. He instantly filed suit for a separation from his wife, prefatory to a divorce. It was to be one of the few times in his life that Tom Anderson did not get his way in the local justice system. Appearing before a judge in civil district court, Anderson accused his wife of excesses of cruel treatment and outrages, and of threatening to shoot him with a loaded pistol. Contesting the suit, Catherine denied ever threatening her husband, and in turn cited a few transgressions of his, among them compelling her at times to perform various duties such as scrubbing, washing, and cooking, refusing to permit a servant to perform said duties. She further accused him of using the most profane and vulgar language toward her, of humiliating her in the presence of his employees, and of treating her in an outrageous manner for which she could never forgive him. And as if this weren't enough, she rounded off her case with a whopping revelation. Catherine Anderson alleged that she was now pregnant with child. As a mother-to-be then, she was entitled to support in the amount of $100 per month in perpetuity, along with a fair portion of Tom's existing assets. Whether Catherine's alleged pregnancy was real or merely a ploy to earn the judge's sympathy, there appears to be no record of any child ever being born, it got the job done. The court ultimately ruled in the wife's favor, refusing the divorce and holding the husband responsible for his wife's continued upkeep. Anderson began an appeal, but meanwhile he had to suffer the indignity of having court assessors rummage through his home and businesses, inventorying all of his assets, right down to the $2 keg of pickles in the cellar of his restaurant. It's possible that one point of contention in his marriage was Anderson's growing association with the brothel madam Josie Lebrano, now calling herself Josie Arlington. Rumors of a romantic relationship between the two would persist for decades, but there's no real evidence that they were ever anything more than close friends and business partners. Most likely, Tom recognized in Josie a kindred spirit, another no-nonsense pragmatist with a determination to succeed in one of the few ways available in 1890s New Orleans to persons not born to wealth and privilege. For Josie, too, was now a business person on the rise. The 4 or 5 years since the killing of her brother had been transformative for her. She'd successfully shed the taint of her former rough life and started out anew, just as she had vowed to do back in 1891. She'd taken up with a new paramour, John Thomas, Tom Brady, an easygoing, mild-mannered clerk in the city treasurer's office, much closer to her own age than Philip Lebrano had been. Several months after the shooting, she and Brady had gone off on an extended vacation to Hot Springs, Arkansas. There, they'd witnessed firsthand the lush life offered by the city's celebrated Arlington Hotel, a luxurious spa where the well-heeled could take a water cure amid the trappings of Gilded Age opulence. For a former orphaned child, once forced by her aunt to sell apples on street corners, only to be beaten unmercifully if she didn't bring back $1.50 a day, this was a revelation, a potent vision of a very different and desirable kind of life. Josie came back to New Orleans, resolved to recreate a bit of that elegance at her Custom House Street brothel. She changed the name of her establishment to the Chateau Lebrano Darlington, and proceeded to fill it with gracious, amiable foreign girls who would be at home only to gentlemen of taste and refinement. She even began advertising her high-toned new offerings in the newspapers. Society is graced by the presence of a bona fide baroness, direct from the court of St. Petersburg, ran one announcement in the Mascot. The baroness is at present residing incognito at the Chateau Lebrano Darlington, and is known as La Belle Stuart. True, the alleged baroness was soon exposed as nothing more than a hoochie-coochie dancer and circus specialist, but the tone that Josie was striving for was evident nonetheless. Perhaps in part to finance her wholesale image renovation, Josie Arlington sold an interest in the chateau to her friend Tom Anderson, whose Rampart Street restaurant stood just around the corner. Whether this was Anderson's first foray into the brothel business is uncertain, but it would not be his last. The saloon and brothel businesses, after all, were natural complements, and it wasn't long before the bar at 112 Rampart Street became a popular stopping-off place for clients heading to or from the chateau at 142 Custom House. To cement the association in the mind of the public, Tom eventually renamed his restaurant the Arlington. Soon, both establishments were prospering mightily, enriching both principals and even allowing the genial Tom Brady, a friend of Anderson's, in addition to being Arlington's kept man, to quit his job at the city treasurer's office and invest in a local pool hall. So, for Tom Anderson, Josie Arlington, and their associates in Vice, things weren't going too badly in the New Orleans of the mid-1890s. Business was good, despite a nationwide depression, and harassments from police were minimal. But the forces of reform had not been idle, and the outlook for the city's vice industries was about to change significantly. A new and more energetic reform administration had been elected to office in 1896, and they were ready to ratchet up the battle to clean up the city. Under the leadership of Mayor Walter C. Flower, this new administration set its sights in particular on the spread of vice and crime into respectable neighborhoods all around the city, and their proposed solution to the problem was a uniquely practical one. Recognizing that any attempt to abolish vice entirely was doomed to failure, at least in New Orleans, they hoped instead to regulate and isolate the trade, and they would do it by moving vice out of the central city and the better residential neighborhoods into a part of town where few respectable people would come into contact with it. Drawing boundaries to isolate vice and crime was the new progressive answer of the day, and it would ultimately change the culture of New Orleans in ways that no one could anticipate. For a place with such a deeply entrenched culture of prostitution, of course, any scheme to segregate the practice would not be easy to implement. New Orleans' reputation as a center of sin and perdition had dogged the city virtually since its founding in 1718. Established in that year under a temporary charter to the private Company of the West, La Nouvelle Orléans was from the beginning a community filled with rough, ungovernable men and women of dubious morality. John Law, the notorious Scottish adventurer who had contracted with France to establish 30 leagues up the river a burg which should be called New Orleans, needed to populate his new town as quickly as possible, and he wasn't overly fastidious about how he accomplished the task. According to one early historian, "Disorderly soldiers, black sheep of distinguished families, paupers, prostitutes, political suspects, friendless strangers, unsophisticated peasants straying into Paris, all were kidnapped, herded, and shipped under guard to fill the emptiness of Louisiana." French jails and hospitals were ransacked for potential colonists, while men with an opportunistic bent were enticed with promises of free transportation, free land, and the prospect of fabulous riches derived from a region of unimaginable abundance. To deal with a chronic shortage of women, prospective wives were also imported from the old country, among them 88 inmates from a Parisian house of correction known as La Salpêtrière. As a result, the town was, within a decade of its birth, already famous as a den of iniquity, a place without religion, without justice, without discipline, without order, and without police. By the latter half of the 18th century, New Orleans had polished away some of its rougher frontier edges, and had even attained a patina of French refinement in parts. But the city retained its notoriety for vice and lawlessness. Subsequent political upheavals did little to change this. In 1762, to avoid surrendering New Orleans and western Louisiana to Britain after the Seven Years' War, known in North America as the French and Indian War, King Louis XV secretly ceded these territories to his Spanish cousin, King Carlos III. But although Spain took political and military control of Louisiana for the rest of the century, the Spaniards sent over few additional colonists. As a result, New Orleans remained distinctly French and libertine in character. Spain did, however, rebuild much of the central city after two devastating fires, which is why the architecture of the French Quarter is actually Spanish. In 1800, the whole territory reverted to France, but by then, the mother country's ardor for its unruly American colony had cooled. 3 years later, Napoleon sold New Orleans and the whole Louisiana Territory to the United States for the sum of $15 million. Residents had no say in this matter, and were not at all pleased, but nothing could be done. And so, in 1803, the old Gallic metropolis became American, at least politically. The population explosion set off by the Louisiana Purchase took New Orleans vice to new levels of visibility. Tenderloin districts grew up along the busy waterfront, where rowdy flatboatmen from the American interior, carrying cargoes downriver to the newly unrestricted port, indulged in sprees of gambling, drinking, and wholehearted wallowing in the flesh pots. Soon, the rise of the Mississippi steamboat culture was bringing a somewhat higher class of scalawag to the Crescent City, in the form of confidence men and professional riverboat gamblers. Gambling, in fact, became something of an obsession for New Orleanians of every class, and although the Louisiana state legislature, occasionally dominated by conservative elements from the state's Anglo-Protestant North, passed various anti-gambling laws over the years, they were, in New Orleans at least, widely ignored. Efforts to control prostitution were likewise ineffectual. By the mid-1800s, prosperous Anglo-American planters and merchants had built entire neighborhoods of capacious, colonnaded mansions in the American part of the city, the Garden District, upriver from Canal Street. Here, they hoped to set themselves apart from the neighborhoods of downtown Creoles, a term that at this point meant the offspring, white, black, or mixed race, of French or other foreign-born parents. To keep their enclaves free of sin, efforts were made to regulate prostitution by city statute, but thanks to lax enforcement over the years, the problem of vice contamination in respectable neighborhoods did not go away, and in fact by 1890 seemed worse than ever. But now, with the election of the new reform government of 1896, city officials were determined to make vice segregation work. Just after the election, a newly installed alderman named Sidney Story took it on himself to devise a way to protect the pure and noble womanhood of New Orleans from this unwanted contamination. "That vice should be allowed to flaunt its scarlet drapery in the face of virtue," as he would later opine to the item, "was not only a blotch upon our escutcheon, but a constant menace to the moral health of the community." So, Story developed a plan that would make prostitution illegal everywhere in the city, except in a certain 18-block area, a neighborhood that was already rife with vice establishments. In this way, sin would be drawn out of prominent and respectable parts of town and relegated to places where, he believed, it would do the least harm to decent sensibilities. This was not an entirely new idea. Story had seen similar schemes in several European cities during a tour of the continent some years earlier. And even some American cities had experimented with officially tolerated vice districts. What made Story's plan unique, however, was the explicitness of the toleration and the specificity of its geographical limits. And since the proposed ordinance did not actually legalize prostitution within this area, but merely made it illegal everywhere else, it would be able to survive the inevitable court challenges it was bound to inspire. Story's innovative new idea was widely applauded by the city's business reformers in particular. They hoped that isolating vice in this way would improve New Orleans' reputation and thus make it easier to attract northern capital investment. Even the conservative Daily Picayune lauded the proposal, looking forward to a time when the perpetrators of vice and immorality would operate only in obscure neighborhoods where decent people will not constantly be offended by their open and shameless flaunting. The city's so-called moral reformers, the clergymen, blue stockings, and others who would rather have outlawed prostitution entirely, were naturally less pleased, but even they seemed willing at least to give the new proposal a chance. The area designated as the so-called restricted district, though it soon would be known as Storyville, much to the alderman's annoyance, was located behind the Vieux-Carré, downriver of Canal Street. This was a mixed-race working-class neighborhood that contained only one church, the Union Chapel, a Methodist Episcopal establishment with an exclusively African-American congregation that lacked any political clout. A second, much smaller area uptown of Canal Street, eventually known as Black Storyville, was also designated, though unofficially, in order to forestall a wholesale exodus of black prostitutes already entrenched there. Known prostitutes in all other parts of town would be ordered to move to the restricted districts by a certain deadline. If they did not comply, notices of eviction, signed by Mayor Flower himself, would be sent and acted upon if necessary. On January 29, 1897, Alderman Story's ordinance was passed by the City Council. An amended version would be passed again in July. And so, on the first day of 1898, Storyville would officially be born. Long before that date, of course, brothel landlords and other vice entrepreneurs scrambled to establish beachheads within the confines of the new district. And one of the first among them was Tom Anderson. Always well connected to sources of insider information, he moved quickly to acquire a choice property in Storyville to be. He bought the Fair Play Saloon, a large restaurant located on the corner of Basin Street and Custom House, right at the point where most visitors would be entering the district, and made plans to renovate it into a showplace. Josie Arlington, too, acquired a lavish property on Basin Street, just a few doors down from Anderson's. The vast commercial potential of operating within a legally tolerated vice district was not lost on either of the two entrepreneurs, and they were determined to take full advantage of the opportunity. Anderson in particular saw the coming change as propitious. Until now, he'd had to operate his more questionable enterprises on the gray margins of the law, subject to the whim of any overzealous police captain or city politician eager to make a show of cracking down on vice and petty crime. Now, Anderson would be able to operate with the explicit blessing of the authorities. To him, it seemed like an ideal arrangement. Maybe this new crop of reformers wasn't so bad. With enemies like this, who needed friends? And so, Anderson began to lay his plans. He could set up shop in a bigger way in the new district. He could call in some political favors from his friends at the Choctaw Club, where the Ring political organization held court, and get himself elected to some position that might prove useful. And maybe he could even find some way of getting rid of his unwanted second spouse. For a man with an entrepreneurial streak and a flexible sense of propriety, the possibilities in this new scheme were virtually endless. As for Alderman Story, Mayor Flower, and the other reformers, they too had good reason to expect that their segregated vice district would be a success, lending a semblance of order to a chaotic aspect of the city's life that had resisted all previous attempts at regulation. What they did not anticipate, however, was quite how wildly successful their well-meaning social experiment would become. Chapter 6. New Sounds. But there was another phenomenon brewing in those areas soon to be set aside by the city fathers as enclaves of sin. At first, no one, certainly not those city fathers themselves, would recognize it as anything significant or worthy of notice. But for the one quarter of New Orleanians designated in the census as Negro, the phenomenon would come to be very important indeed. A way of coping with the changes around them, a way of holding their own, of asserting their identity in a time of adversity. The new sound was born sometime in the mid-1890s, in the working-class black clubs and honky-tonks near the poor uptown neighborhood soon to be known as Black Storyville. You could hear it in the venues on and around South Rampart Street, at Dago Tony's, the Red Onion, Oddfellows Hall, or farther afield, in the Negro Dives on the other side of Canal. For a time, the music was known only to those who flocked to such places, the so-called ratty people, the good-time, earthy people, as one musician of the day defined them. But before too long, the new sound was also being heard in parks, on street corners, in dance halls, and in places well beyond the confines of the city's destitute black neighborhoods. And that, naturally, was when the trouble started. No one ever recorded the New Orleans musicians of the 1890s, so it's difficult to say for sure that it was a young uptown cornetist named Buddy Bolden who first played the music later known as jazz. Certainly many others, black, mixed race, and even white, would eventually lay claim to the distinction. But many of his contemporary musicians believed that Bolden was the man who started it all, and to hear them tell the story, he was extraordinary. "That boy could make women jump out the window," one of his early listeners said. "He had a moan in his cornet that went all through you." For many people in New Orleans, accustomed to the straighter, more schooled styles of music that preceded it, the Bolden sound was a revelation. "I'd never heard anything like that before," one convert would later say. "I'd played legitimate stuff, but this, it was something that pulled me in. They got me up on the bandstand and I played with them. After that, I didn't play legitimate so much." Charles Joseph Buddy Bolden, like so many of the jazzmen who would follow him, grew up poor and without much in the way of material prospects. The grandson of slaves, he was born on September 6, 1877, in a small house on Howard Street in uptown New Orleans. As neighborhoods go, it was not a very healthy place to live, perched on the edge of a fetid and foul-smelling canal. By the time Buddy was 6 years old, he had lost his father, one sister, and his grandmother to various illnesses. Buddy and his sister Cora moved around with their mother Alice for the next few years, probably staying with relatives and friends, then finally settling in a small shotgun cottage at 385 First Street. This was a tough but integrated area, not unusual in the New Orleans at the time, populated mostly by German and Irish laborers who seemed to have little trouble getting along with their black neighbors. Mrs. Bolden made a modest living there as a laundress, earning enough to allow her two young children to stay in school without working themselves. For a 10-year-old boy with a yet unrealized musical gift, working-class New Orleans in the 1880s was an auspicious place to grow up. Music was everywhere around him, and thanks to the cosmopolitan nature of the city's population, it was as varied as it was ubiquitous. Peddlers in the alleys advertised their wares by blowing riffs on old tin horns. Spasm bands of children, wielding cigar-box banjos and soapbox basses, played tunes for handouts on street corners. Latin and Caribbean songs spilled from the decks of ships at anchor on the wharves. In that age before radio, events like parades and picnics were the everyday diversions, and each one came with its own performing brass bands. Churches, meanwhile, reverberated with hymns and spirituals. Dock workers sang work songs and blues, and even funerals were held with a complete musical accompaniment. "The city was full of the sounds of music," one old-time New Orleanian remembered. "It was like a phenomenon, like the Aurora Borealis. The sound of men playing would be so clear, but we wouldn't be sure where it was coming from. So we'd start trotting, start moving. It's this way, it's that way. Music could come on you any time like that." Despite being surrounded by this feast of sounds, however, young Bolden apparently had no musical training until about 1894, at the age of 16 or 17. That was when his mother allowed him to take cornet lessons from a neighbor named Manuel Hall, a short-order cook who was keeping company with her at the time. It was a late start for a musician, but Buddy learned quickly. He also had plenty of opportunities to play. The city's established brass bands, groups like the Excelsior, Onward, and Eureka bands, would sometimes work long days, playing funerals or association affairs that stretched from early morning to very late at night. The older musicians would need a break now and then to have a beer or simply to rest their chops, and teenagers like Buddy would fill in for them. By 1897, though, he was already playing with his own regular band at parades and picnics. And despite, or maybe because of, his lack of formal training, he was soon attracting attention by ragging the hymns, street songs, and dance tunes to create a musical sound that people were unfamiliar with. The Bolden sound, to hear witnesses describe it, was hot, wide open, low down, and, like his most ardent fans, ratty. It was bluesy and folksy, music that made you want to dance. Like many uptown black musicians, Buddy couldn't read music very well, but that didn't matter much, since he could pick up anything he needed by ear. He could go and hear a band playing in the theater, one old friend recalled, and he'd come on out and practice in between dances, and that morning, before the ball was over, he'd play that piece and play it well. And it wasn't only other bands he borrowed from. According to another contemporary, Bolden got ideas from everywhere, from what he heard in the Holy Roller churches he sometimes attended with his mother and sister, or even from the man peddling rags with his tin horn. Buddy, he stole lots of things from the rag man, one friend confessed. But each time, he'd put his own feeling to it, and thus make it his own. And the music he made was electric. It was showy, improvisational, sometimes raunchy, and always very, very loud. Bolden would blow so hard, one musician claimed, he actually blew the tuning slide out of his cornet, and it would land 20 feet away. This, of course, is a physical impossibility, but it was only one of the legends that eventually grew up around the Bolden persona. Young Buddy did not, for instance, publish a scandal sheet called The Cricket, and he was not a barber. He did, however, spend a lot of time in barber shops, as did many of the early jazzmen, since the shops were common rendezvous points for musicians assembling personnel for upcoming gigs. At Charlie Galloway's barber shop on South Rampart Street in the late 90s, Bolden, still in his teens, got many of his earliest jobs. Working by day as a laborer and occasional plasterer, he would play by night in the neighborhood halls and honky-tonks, and the Bolden band was soon attracting plenty of attention and spawning a raft of imitators.